some of the people you've talked to have dreamed about going to Mars. Tell me about that, and tell me about whether or not it's one of your dreams. Into Moon Bounce, going to Mars, keep to RIW. You got it, Barry.
I can hear the laughter in your voice. Anyway, what I've heard is a little different scenario. I heard that they want to send a number of unmanned, just rockets, to Mars. They want to set something up, and I'm not sure how they plan on doing this, that will fill the atmosphere of Mars over a period of possibly 100 years with a thick smoke. The idea is that the atmosphere will get warmer because of the smoke will, you know, the sunlight will warm up the ground, the water will melt, and eventually, over a period of maybe 200 years, they can produce some kind of atmosphere. That's what I heard. So it's not a short-term thing. They're not planning on doing this immediately. Planning on doing this over a period of possibly 200 years, several generations down the road, before anything could actually be done on Mars. N2MB.
Yeah, this sounds a little bit similar to what science fiction writers have called terraforming. We literally significantly change the environment of a planet by using some good science. Still, where is all the atmosphere going to come from? The total number of tons of atmosphere on planet Earth is a huge number. Even though, if you saw it to scale, the thickness of the atmosphere is not much different than the thickness of the paint that's on that globe that sat on your teacher's desk in that geology class you went to, or that geography class you went to. The atmosphere is kind of thin, but it's lots and lots of tons of stuff. And to protect you from solar wind, cosmic rays, and whatever, you need a magnetic field and you need a thick atmosphere. And is there enough water on Mars that if you just heat it up and the water that's in frozen form turns into liquid? Let me drop. So this 200-year plan that you've heard about, Barry, where did you read that? Was that a pretty well-respected journal? M2 Moonbounce, K2IW, and Barry, would you volunteer to go there if it was available to you?
Not for 200 years. not now, no. I think it's too hostile right now. I don't remember where I heard that. I can't remember. I read it, but I don't remember where. It was over a year or 2 years ago that I read this thing. And they think that there is a lot of water on Mars. It's not readily accessible at this time, but maybe under the surface. That's why they're drilling holes in the planet. They're looking for things like that. And I hope they find it. And 2MB.
Keeping M2 here.
Rich Recognize is going to go to you in a second. Barry, if we could talk you into going to Mars, boy, would you be a DX contact.
Wow.
You'd be country number 316, so to speak. Everybody's going to talk to you. Boy, would you be popular on 80 through 10 meters and all the other bands, Barry. You wouldn't have to worry about ionospheric absorption. There ain't any. So transmitting the signals and receiving the signals from Mars, that's the easy part. And one-third gravity, I mean, boy, when you're doing high jumping and broad jumping, or just playing running the marathon with one-third gravity, as long as you've got a good supply of oxygen, boy, that would be kind of fun. N2EO, K2IW. Go ahead, Rich. I bet you wouldn't volunteer.
Oh, no, I wouldn't volunteer either. It's a one-way trip. So at least now, if they get involved, it's only a one-way trip. Just one. Called you earlier, you must have been out. So back to that. By the way, it's freezing.
out in carrier. I'm listening on the input as well as the output, and 20% of the time, that time, you were dropping out every couple of seconds. You tried to communicate with me today, is what I sensed you say in between the drops. Did you send me an email or a telephone message? What was the method by which you tried to get a hold of me, Rich? Or maybe you tried signing in earlier. And maybe because of the dropouts, we didn't hear you. N2EO, T2RIW.
Oh, it's my fault, Dick. On this end, I kept letting go of the push to talk on that transmission. I just wanted to say good evening to you guys. And I had no heat to it today. I gotta get the guy over here tomorrow to fix the heat. And that's all I got to say. Dick, over to you. Hello to you also, Barry. Jeanette, and to you. Not bad.
Rich, did you say you tried signing in earlier and you weren't able to get through? Is that what I heard you say on the two transmissions ago? Go ahead.
No, I'm just checking in now.
Okay, you checked in now. You have the opportunity to ask a question about space or non-space. It's your choice. Over to you, Rich.
No, I don't have any questions, Dick. I appreciate it. I just wanted to say good evening. Back to Ned and to you.
As I see it, Paul, it's going to take a pretty serious advertising campaign to advertise Mars. As you know, there is a lady on Long Island, a very accomplished I believe she's a 17-year-old or a senior in high school with very high grades. And in the selection committee where they're selecting people to go to Mars on this one-way trip, she was in Newsday and being described as being very enthusiastic about it. So there are people who definitely want to go. And no matter how many people you go there, even if it's just one way, what are they going to do there? I can think of some science you can do for a while. And after you get all of those answers with all your science experiments, what do you do with it? And inhabiting that place is very difficult. Most of the time, by our standards, it's cold as all hell.
Dick, I'll go with the 17-year-old.
Give us some words on that. You're saying that if you were allowed to go with the 17-year-old on a one-way trip, and you're not kidding me, you would go. And you believe that Cinder would agree to this. Over to you, Barry.
You know I'm kidding. I just thought I would inject that, though.
Yeah, it's sort of like saying, I can't get away to marry you today. My wife won't let me. we can dream. But there are many more closer to home goals that are a little bit more easy to accomplish in all kinds of fields of science. It looks like Elon Musk is going to be launching vehicles that possibly have the capability of going there in an unmanned manner. And I think you've made it sound like in the vicinity of the year 2018, he'll be ready to do that. And he's willing to invest $300 million of his own money to do that, is what I think you're saying, Paul. That is enthusiasm. WS2N, K2RIW, wait for the beeps.
Yes, that's right. It's about $60 million to launch one Falcon 9. I was going to put three of them together. And that drives the course up, plus the spacecraft itself. And the spacecraft itself is a crewed vehicle, so it would be, he's got a cargo vehicle, but the same dimensions and everything is what the crewed vehicle looks like. And that will be Now, he also plans on sending every 2 years another one of these, at least one, you know, just this type of spacecraft. I say 2 years, it's really every 26 months. Every 26 months, the window opens up. So, that's his plan. By the way, if we could get Barry on the Mars, then instead of moon bounce, it could be Mars bounce, I guess, on the call letters. That would really work. That's what I was hoping for when I was younger. To develop, you know, a complete developed base on the moon. Let me drop it. So probably on the South Pole, near Shackleton Crater. That's where anybody who's thinking about this, the Russians, China, India, we're kind of out of it right now. We plan on putting up a space station in cislunar orbit 40,000 miles out from the moon, and, you know, just having a regular space station there, but we don't have any plans of landing back on the moon. But I would have liked to have seen that, talk about when I was younger. I could imagine a base on the moon, and we could have had QSL cards going back and forth. There definitely would have been hams there, just, you know, no different than Antarctica. That would have been cool. And so this generation, yeah, I'm sure they have hopes of doing the same with Mars. I was actually thinking, as time went on, I got older and they were getting better at this stuff. Let me drop it. That by now we would have people starting to colonize the moon Titan. And that has a, you know, very heavy atmosphere. Very heavy nitrogen atmosphere. And, you know, Carl Sagan's guess, and he was right, was that they probably have lakes of ethane. And they do. They have lakes as big as Lake Superior of floating ethane. And, you know, someday you're going to have a robotic craft landing there that will be able to float. And there's even plans on a drawing board to have a submarine go down underneath the lakes on the moon Titan. By the way, Titan, if anybody doesn't know, is one of the moons going around Saturn. So, and it's not too far-fetched. We've actually had a land there at one time, parachutes and landed and sent back information. Back to you, Dick, WS2M.
Well, what's the surface temperature of Titan?
Paul's going to tell us. Go ahead, Paul.
No, I know it's cold. You know, it's probably minus 300 degrees or something like that. I don't have the information offhand, but it's way down there.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I found a calculator which is going to tell me at what altitude does 0.6% air pressure occur, and I've guessed that it's in the vicinity of 100,000 feet. So we know how difficult it is to live on the top of Mount Everest. People who go there without oxygen don't survive very long, and that's 29,000 feet. And I think that's something in the vicinity of one-third normal atmospheric pressure. To go down to 0.6%, that's what, a couple of hundred times less than we've got at sea level. Boy, that's very little air pressure. And Barry, you did talk about the science fiction story you read where if they put enough fog on Mars, and there's so little atmosphere, establishing that fog is not easy. Let me drop it. But if you establish enough fog of just the right kind, you do get greenhouse effect heating. But the thermal time constant of Mars, if you look at it as a solid object, the thermal time constant of that object might be 1 million years. So to heat up Mars, by the means that you and I are talking about, there's another hidden situation going on, I see. Thermal time constant is a function of how much mass have you got, what's the thermal capacity of that mass, specific heat, I think they call it, and what is its surface area. A mosquito, when it flies from your living room to your dining room, it settles on the new temperature in a couple of seconds. A whale, when he swims from Florida to New York, where the water is cooler, I don't know what his thermal time constant is, but it might be a good fraction of a week. He's a much more massive object. The mass of an object goes up as a function of a diameter cubed, but the surface area only goes up as diameter squared. So as an object gets bigger and bigger, even if it's made out of the exact same stuff, let me drop. Because the mass is increasing quite a bit faster by square law, by mass is increasing by cube law, surface area is only increasing by square law. So you very rapidly come up with a larger and larger object, bigger and bigger thermal time constant. So we can find out what is the thermal time constant of Mars. It might be well over a million years. So this thermal heating process that you've described, I'll admit you don't have to heat the whole planet. Maybe you've only got to heat it down to the first couple of miles below the surface to get to the water we're talking about. But the rest of the planet below that is going to be draining away that heat. Do you see the problem I'm worried about here now? We've come up with a brand new problem on your fog project, Barry. Intermoonbound. Maybe you need thicker fog. And by the way, the amount of sunlight hitting Mars is a small fraction of what hits Earth. Again, that slows down the heating process. Intermoonbound, K2LIW. We need some nuclear energy here, Barry.
But possibly or better ideas. I know. I hear what you're saying, and I didn't think about that. I thought if you could warm the surface, but you're telling me even if you could bring the surface up to 70 degrees, it wouldn't be long before it went down again because of the fact that the planet itself is so cold. I don't know. I got to think about that.
Yeah, we got to think warm thoughts, Barry. Think big and think warm thoughts. On paper, at first, terraforming, modifying a planet, sounds nice and desirable. But a colony on the moon, a colony on Mars, changing the characteristics of these heavenly bodies, when you get down to the specifics, it's tough. You can imagine about saying that, hey, I want to heat up the whole darn Earth, or I want to change the thickness of the atmosphere of Earth. By your and my standards, Earth is very big. And to make those changes, not so easy. And Mars is a bit smaller, but still. We're talking about big numbers here. I'm having trouble believing that we're going to put a colony there. For us to have a civilization that lives on two planets. Let me drop. I mean, in the United Kingdom, when it comes to the people who are likely to become the king in the future, they say that after Diana, they've got an heir and they've got a spare. Well, when it comes to where do humans live? We've got Earth and a spare. Is that spare going to be Mars? I'm kind of doubtful. Give us some more words on some of the future launches coming up, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW, what should we look forward to?
Well, we just had OSIRIS-REx go up, and that's going to the asteroid Bennu. So that's successful. That's on its way. And in 2018, it should start going in orbit around it and eventually bring a sample back. So that was successful. But future launches, you have tests. That's again 2018. That's what I'm saying. A lot of things happened in 2018. And that's going to be very similar to Kepler with, you know, detecting the light of stars and the dimming of the star to detect planets that will be going up in T2 orbit. You know, that's the one that we talked about that's going to be going out to the lunar orbit, not near the moon, but, you know, to that area and very close to Earth, 6,000 miles close to Earth, and then back up to the lunar orbit again. So that's coming up. Let me drop it. There's many missions going up worldwide. Next month you have China launching a crew of three, crew of two, it was going to be three, they changed it to two, to their new space station, and that's called Tiangong 2. That was successfully launched a couple of weeks ago. So that's now in orbit. Tiangong 1, their first space station, is now out of control and going to crash somewhere into the planet. But you know, that operated successfully from, I think, 2011, so that had almost a five-year run. Although they only had two actual crews docked with Tiangong 1. Tiangong, by the way, is Heavenly Palace. That's what they have translated to. So they have the Tiangong series. There's going to be a Tiangong 3, which will start probably again 2018 to be completed in 2022. Let me drop it. That will be a modular design. That's why it'll take so many years to develop it. Maybe four or five different modules that will be attached. And that will be their permanent space station. It travels at a lower latitude inclination than ours, or the Mir. Ours is at what, 51.6 degrees latitude. This thing is around 42, I think, around 42 degrees. So they have a different latitude, and that's due to where they launch it from. You know, whatever weight that they could launch, their highest latitude could be that number. By the way, they opened up a new launch facility around 15 degrees north of the equator. Now they have, I think, four different launch complexes, locations in China. And they're going to be launching a brand new rocket. They have the Long March series, for instance, the Tiangong space station that I just mentioned that went up, went on a Long March 2, and then the crew will also be launched on Long March 2. They've been developing new ones over the last 10, 15 years. One that they just tested about a year ago called Long March 7. That will be a medium range, bigger than what they have now, but what they're going to consider medium. And then there's going to be a much more powerful one. This is in the realm of the Delta 4, what we use for our heavy lift vehicle right now. And that's called Long March 5. Well, these new rockets are going to be launched from a new location. I think it's what H, I forget the name of it. But 15 degrees north of the equator. So China's going full blast. And they'll be putting up their permanent manned space station with that. And also lunar and Mars missions from that launch complex. A lot more, Dick. You know, the list is endless. I think we have one that I think is in jeopardy. Let me drop it. And that's called the ARM mission, ARM, Asteroid Redirect Mission. That's been planned. You know, they've got funding. There's a lot of money that's already gone into this, but such. They plan on sending a unmanned rocket to rendezvous with an asteroid, similar to what we're doing with OSIRIS-REx, but much bigger. And they plan on going down to the asteroid, picking up a large asteroid, you know, I'm talking about something about 15 feet in diameter, grab a hold of this thing, and bring it back and put it into the orbit of the moon. This is NASA I'm talking about, by the way. This is us. Put it into the orbit around the moon, and while it's there, let me drop it. Use the space launch system that we're developing now, this space launch system that's going to be, roughly equal to the Saturn V rocket, and that's going to be launching the Orion spacecraft with a crew on board. And you launch a crew on the space launch system from Florida, and you go out to the orbit of the moon, which is going to be, again, around 40,000 miles away from the moon, and actually dock with the asteroid, and then do an EVA, go out, chisel a couple of pieces off this thing, bring it back in a toolbox that looks like the size of a toolbox, bring it inside the Orion spacecraft, undock, and fly back to Earth. And this is called the ARM, the Asteroid Redirect Mission. I don't know. I've seen a lot of, some articles. I don't know if it's got its full support in Congress or whoever supports these missions. It's been funded, but I wouldn't be surprised if this one gets taken away. Back to you, Dick.
The mission to grab a piece of an asteroid and move it. Wow. Do you get enough in return for the investment? Let me go back to TESS. TESS, as I remember, is a super version of Kepler. I think Kepler was looking at something like 100,000 stars all at once. And I think Tesla is going to look at something like an even larger number of stars. And I think it's even got the sensitivity of seeing smaller amounts of dipping of the light coming out when a planet goes in front of a star. Is that roughly true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, it is, and they're going to be looking at the more local stars near us, a couple hundred light years away, instead of, 6,000 light years away, distance. They really were staring at one spot in space. This thing's going to search the whole northern and southern hemisphere. By the way, they have a contract. NASA has a contract with SpaceX, Elon Musk, to launch this thing in 2018. So that's a concern there. I really hope they narrow down this explosion that they had on the launch complex 40, their launch complex. Back to you there.
I tried plugging in 0.6% atmospheric pressure into this online program that calculates altitude on the Earth. It'll give you that amount of atmospheric pressure. And the program keeps saying, out of range. You can't go that high. They didn't design the program correctly. And as you get up to super high altitudes, it's not a linear function. As you get up to higher altitudes, the total amount of air above you is less. That's part of the reason why the air pressure is lower. Oh well, I'm guessing 100,000 feet. We'll eventually confirm it. But without a doubt, in order to come out of your housing, out of your habitat, you got to wear a spacesuit. And as far as you're concerned, the spacesuit in the vacuum of being outside of the International Space Station doing a spacewalk, and outside of Mars is not that different. It's very, very close. Let me drop.
I think it was around 300,000 feet, Dick.
Okay, so you've heard that the, at 300,000 feet on the Earth, you've got the same air pressure as you do on Mars. That's what you heard, Paul? Go ahead.
Well, you got similar to pressure up about, I think, about 100 miles above the planet. Because what they did was they launched those SIADs, they call them. These were these inflating balloon type things. They tested these, two of them, in Hawaii. They launched from an Air Force base in one of the islands of Hawaii, and they got up to, I think, 80 or 90,000 feet, almost 100,000 feet, and then they dropped this rocket, and, you know, with this round disc on it. The round disc was, I don't know, it looked like about 15 feet in diameter to start with, and then they launched it to around 300,000 feet with this rocket, and it was a solid booster type rocket, and it got up to around 300,000 feet. And the reason they did this is to duplicate the atmosphere on Mars, and then, you know, they were able to get up to that speed that they'd be coming down and open up this balloon, and then eventually open up the parachute, which they did, but I think one of the parachutes ripped, so they had to do a do-over, and they had another problem. Back to you.
It's possible they went to 300,000 feet so that when they fell back down, they would get up to the atmosphere, get up to the velocity of a Mars encounter before hitting the atmosphere and deploying their parachute-like thing. But still, those are the kind of altitudes we're talking about. Tangang 1. Tangang 1 is now out of control. It's been up for 5 years. And it's going to come back down. Has anybody made a rough estimate as to when it's going to come back down? Is it a month, 6 months, 2 years? What's your guess, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Yeah, Tangang 1's falling at, it's at 300 feet a day. So, at its altitude, they said it would come down probably, the fall of 2017, but out of control, you know, completely out of control. So, and I think they said about 20 or 30% of it might make it to the ground.
No one has talked about a rescue mission where you boost it back up, or no one has talked about a rescue mission where you intentionally do a retro burn and you make sure it lands in the Pacific Ocean. There's been no discussions along those lines, Paul, because in the orbit it is in, I'm guessing it does pass over a substantial amount of inhabited land areas. Yes, 3/4 of the planet is water, and therefore there's a 75% chance it's going to hit water. But you know Murphy's Law. If there's a 25% chance it's going to hit land, you know what that means. So nobody has talked about a rescue or a retro burn mission, Nepal, WS2N, K2IW.
I did read that about a year or so ago when they lost control of it. They said that they should have had a rescue mission attached to it. But, you know, and once it starts rotating, that's it. You'll never be able to stop it or do anything. You can't match the spin of this thing to dock with it. So, you know, it's got to be stable when you dock with it. And then you can do it, but that's not going to happen. And, I don't know, I guess they used to not worrying about things like that. You know, when they launch their boosters, they don't let boosters land on, because now on land, now the new space port that they built, in order to, the boosters will wind up in the China Sea. So they're okay there. But all these other boots come down and land, you know. I see pictures where the people are grabbing a hold of these spent boots and dragging pieces off. I don't know what they're going to do with it. But I guess they're used to this type of thing. You know, we had the same problem with Skylab. You know, that was hit and miss, too. Wound up covering a good part of Australia. Back to you, Dick.
I do remember that one of the large containers of some kind that was on board did hit Western Australia. Not too far from an inhabited area. So, 300 feet a day is coming down in altitude, Tongang 1. And even at that rate, it might last until 2017, you're saying. And you said that it's tumbling. Is it already tumbling so fast you can't possibly dock with it? I wonder what's creating that spin. Over to you, Paul. K2RIW.
Well, it's rotating. You know, it's moving. And who knows? Maybe one of the thrusters got stuck. You know, I don't know. But, I mean, even when we used to go up and dock with the Agena spacecraft with the Gemini, remember that? It's a dock with them. But if the Agena was moving, you know, they would have a problem. But if it was moving a little bit, yeah, that would match the rotation of the spacecraft and then dock with it. They were interesting missions. That's why you were able to get the Geminis up so high. You know, the highest height you flew to with Gemini was over 800 miles. Space station is only 250, you know. Here's Gemini, you know, in the 1960s. Going higher than where we are today. And how did we do that? We did that using the booster rocket of the Agena booster rocket that we docked with. That would fly off. An hour and a half later, we would take off and go up with our two-man crew, dock with the thing. But if that thing was rotating, which they did have a problem, in the future they wanted to redock with one of the other ones, one of the older ones that they had put up there, but it was moving, and they opted not to do that and take that chance. Back to you, Dick.
I think there were a couple of missions on either Gemini or Apollo or both where a stuck thruster made the spacecraft start rotating real fast, and by the time the astronaut involved, and I think Armstrong was one of them, by the time he got control of the situation, they were not too far from rotating at the rate at which unconsciousness could take place. Is my memory mixed up on this one, Paul? I think we've had a couple of stuck thrusters that became life-threatening. WS2N, K2RIW.
That was with Armstrong and Scott, I think it was. And that was... Right, I think I'm pretty sure it was Gemini 8. I'll have to check the my records on that, but I'm pretty sure it was Gemini 8. By the time it put in my computer, I'm sure it would come up. And they had the stuck thruster. They docked with the Agena, and they had a stuck thruster in the rear of the spacecraft in the service module. But they didn't know it was stuck. All they reported was, you know, we're rotating. And the spin was increasing. So they got the bright idea to disconnect from Agena. They thought, well, maybe the Agena was doing it, you know, one of their thrusters. So they undocked, and the spin increased dramatically because, you know, now they're undocked, it, even so it's less weight, you know, it's less weight for the thruster to push the thing into a spin, and they went to the point where they were almost blacking out. I think four revolutions per second or something, really fast. Let me drop it. We need peer review to check on the revolutions per second, but it was a extremely fast reach up and grab one of the switches and hit another set of thrusters, retro rockets. He fried them temporarily. And that stopped them. And I think the fuel ran out on that one thruster. And, or closed or something. I'm not sure of the details on that. And then because they used so much fuel up in doing this, they cut the mission short, and they came back early. Back to you there.
I'm pretty sure, yes, that occurred on Gemini when they were docking with Agena, and it became unstable, and there was a misjudgment as to what was causing instability. There was another mission call on the way to the moon where a rotation started happening. I'm reasonably sure that one of the lunar missions, not Apollo 11, 12 or 14, I want to guess, also had a period of a mysterious rotation. And by the way, when you did say on the Gemini mission with Armstrong, I'm having a little trouble believing 4 revolutions per second. Unless your brain happens to be exactly at the center of rotation, 4 revolutions per second could make enough G's if you pressed it up against the side of the spacecraft. You're not going to be able to reach the controls, and you're not going to be able to stay conscious. 4 revolutions per second strikes me awfully high, Paul. Not impossible, but boy, I'm having trouble believing that was survival. Over to you, Paul. KQI, W.
Yeah, that's why I said this one's got to be peer reviewed. That came out of my head, but it was fast. It was to the point where they were go unconscious, and he did have a hard time reaching for the switch, but he knew exactly which toggle to throw, because he was, you know, that they would practice for years in these things before they went up in the simulators, and they say that's one of the reasons that they strongly thought that Armstrong would be a good candidate to be the first guy to land on the moon, because he got himself out of that jam and calm about it. And he also got himself out of that jam. He would fly the flying bed spring. Remember that thing, the flying bed spring in there. They were testing that. It was really supposed to be a simulator for the LEM. And, he wound up blasting out of that. And you fly it all by yourself, and you blast out at the last second, and parachuted down, and the thing crashed and blew up. So, he knew what he was doing. Back to you there.
I do remember that mission, that experiment. And when it comes to the actual lunar landing, because the ground altitude measuring radar was turned on too soon, the computer became overloaded and was giving something like error 1201. And the guy that was in Newsday recently, this week, the guy in the back room who figured out that error 1201 is not bad, as long as it doesn't keep happening too fast, too often. And I'm not sure whether or not they had to do a reboot in order to get it out of that hang-up. But they came very close to aborting the Apollo 11 landing because of the computer overload. I bet you read about that in Newsday this week, Paul. WS2N, K2IW.
No, I didn't read about it, but I think his name was Bates or Gates or something. But I didn't read it. He got the Medal of Freedom or something from the president. Yeah, he made the call. 1201 came up, and they said nobody knew about it, and he yelled out, go with it, 1201, and then flight control. after that 1202 came up, that was another alarm. He yelled out, same thing, go on 1202. And they wound up landing on the moon. Back to you, Dick.
As I see it, that computer was very important because it's got to give you just the right amount of thrust in just the right direction throughout that whole landing sequence so you end up on the right location on the moon. You don't want to be too far downrange, uprange, too high in latitude, too low in latitude, because you've got to be able to easily dock again with the command module, and that docking is awfully important. If you don't dock, you don't come home, or at least you don't come home alive. And so that computer was really needed. I think there was also another award given out for the people who wrote the computer program, so that it had the ability to set the right priorities. It kept using as high priority the landing sequence, and whether or not the ground altitude measuring radar, which was turned on too soon, was giving overload, could at least temporarily be ignored. I think on future missions they made sure that thing was not turned on too soon. Isn't that roughly true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
That's probably what it was. I don't remember what fan. I know they, in simulations, they had it on, and you know, the whole time didn't have to worry about the problem that, you know, it was getting too much information, doing too much at one time, and when they were landing, they did have that problem, and I think in future missions they probably delayed that program for the radar to come on longer. You know, they had a workaround by that time on Apollo 12. Of course, Apollo 13 didn't make it. I'm trying to think of other spacecraft that was going out of control. The only one I could think of was Apollo 13. They had problems. I don't remember. I know 12 had the problem with lightning hitting it. 13 didn't make it. They had a big problem with an explosion on, you know, on the O2 tank. You know, 14, I don't think they had a problem. That was with Shepard, 15 and 16. 15 and 16 and 17 had the Robes. I don't remember any stories about stuck thrusters. There might have been. I might have missed that story, though. Back to you there.
I may have found one you didn't remember, Paul. How about that? I think we're going to confirm. I'm going to make a guess it was either 12 or 14. 12, I think, is the one where the camera on the lunar surface got aimed into the sun by mistake and therefore gave no further pictures. Does that sound familiar? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Which flight was that, did you say?
Either 12 or 14. I think it was 12. And RCA Astro, after that, volunteered a brand new camera, which was not so sun-sensitive, and gave nice high-resolution pictures. This was a color camera on the surface on either 12 or 14, which did briefly get aimed at the sun on the, I guess it's the lunar rover car. The lunar cart, whatever we're going to call it. And that happened, you know, like 10 minutes into the mission when they were doing a EVA on the lunar surface. And from there on, there were no further live video pictures because the mosaic on the camera got so heavily damaged they couldn't give a picture anymore. That was either 12 or 14. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
And that's why they had the problem with the camera. They didn't have any pictures because Alan Bean pointed the camera at the sun. But then, yeah, one of the ones with the rover, I don't remember if they had a complete failure or not on that. 15, 16, and 17, they had rovers. I seem to remember pictures on all three. So maybe to take pictures of the limb taking off from the moon, from the rover. And they wanted to have their camera scan up, but they couldn't figure it. They didn't time it right. And then finally they were successful on 17, the last flight. The guy that was operating it was operating at Houston, you know, in mission control, and he finally figured out how to time it right, and you could see the limb taking off from the moon and going straight up. Back to you there.
Yeah, I think you'd have to set some kind of a timer. The trouble is that when you're looking at the camera giving you a picture from the moon, at the speed of light, it takes 1.25 seconds for that signal to get to you on the Earth, and then you give a command, start panning now, another 1.25 seconds required for the signal to get back up to command the camera. So the 2.5 second round trip time. So you have to be listening to the countdown and issue that command at just the right time, as I see it, knowing what the delays are involved. It's a nasty problem. I don't think they had a timer on board where they could make it happen automatically. On top of that, you know, Murphy's Law is such that the astronauts would take off from the moon a second or two later. Although even that had to be carefully timed in order to minimize the energy required to do the docking, to do the link-up. To do a link-up, you've got to launch from the moon at just the right time, in just the right direction, with just the right thrust, at just the right inclination of orbit, and so on, with the right apogee and perigee of orbit. It's a fairly complicated problem. The first few times they tried doing link-up on Gemini, I think they discovered how difficult it was. I think some of the very early docking missions did not work at first. Isn't that true, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
None of the Geminis were designed to dock with one another. And the first rendezvous, that was rendezvous 6 and 7. 7 went up before 6. And they wound up rendezvousing with one another, going like, you know, 2 feet apart. You could see the other guy in the window. But the first docking missions were with the unmanned Agena rocket. By the way, you know, I'm sure some people were probably wondering what we were talking about with the Flying Bedspring was the nickname. It was called the Lunar Landing Research Vehicle, the LLRV. So, you know, nothing that went into space. It flew on the ground. It had little rocket engines to duplicate zero-G, and then the actual rocket would be flying in it, you know, on the... on this vehicle to duplicate the 1/6 G of the moon. So it was all set up that, and it had a whole bunch of trusses and pieces connected to one another. It looked like a flying bed spring. I just want to verify that. I'm sure people probably will wonder what we're talking about, Dick. Back to you.
On a mission like that, to try to duplicate 1/6 of lunar gravity, I wonder if in some of the early missions that was a tethered mission, where there's some kind of a frame with a cable pulling up, making the spacecraft lighter, getting rid of the 5/6 of Earth's gravity. When you're landing on the moon, your mass stays the same. Your moment of inertia stays the same. It's only the amount of gravity pulling towards the moon that gets drastically cut back. So I wonder if they did any tethered mission experiments at first, Paul. Over to you, K2LIW.
Oh, I don't know. I wonder if they did it robotically, too, without somebody in it. You know, it turned out, you know, they crashed a couple of these things. And any of the astronauts that tried, I remember Cernan talked about it. He said it was terrible. Everybody hated that thing. And it wasn't even flown right. You know, when they landed on the moon, they were standing up. They had to be standing up to one, you know, next to one another. This way they could get up close to the glass and they could get a big field of view. On this thing, they were sitting down, so he was in a sitting position. So, you know, they tried to duplicate things, but, I mean, they were way off. You know, I guess something was better than nothing. They'd probably be a lot better today. Probably be flying a drone or something. Back to you, Dick. We're running out of time. WS2N.
Yeah, in theory, we get cut off in 10 seconds. In theory. This was Space Report, SpaceNet. Here we go. TechNet number 1620. Space Report number 220. 73, you all be kind to each other. We'll be back next week. Over to you, Paul, for tie on the ribbons. WS2N for a final. K2RIW, clear but listening.
Very good, Dick. Another good net. And thank everybody that listened and everybody that participated. We'll be back next time. Same frequency. Same QTH. WS2N clear.
Net tonight at 8:30 W.
KTUPN. Oh, well, what I was interested that the surface temperature on Titan was -290 Fahrenheit. -290 Fahrenheit. And the gravity is 14% of Earth.
Are you telling us, Rich, that you would volunteer to go there? It's just a little bit cool. I mean, all you need is a good warm set of ski clothing, Rich. Go ahead.
I was off by 10 degrees.
Nah, I'm not volunteering to go anywhere, so I'll be about. But not me.
Are you in Pennsylvania yet, Rich?
Yep, I'm on the Pennsy Turnpike heading east. And I'm about, I'm 104 miles in from the Ohio border. Although I entered from West Virginia, not Ohio, but I came in through 70 and then came up to 76. But I'm on 76 now.
If I had to make a guess, Rich, I'd say you might be home on Long Island at around 7 a.m. Over to you, Rich. K2RIW.
I'll probably be in Melville around 6:15, thereabouts. Then we got to go to Farmingville and then back to Queens. So it'll probably be close to 9 o'clock. With the nasty traffic, before I get even thinking about heading home. So I probably won't get home at my house until between 9 and 10.
Yeah, I heard you earlier tonight saying that you could be home as early as 7 a.m., but I know that you were in a big traffic jam. When there is a known traffic prang, as they say in Australia, when there's an accident on the road X number of miles ahead of you on a major road, does your organization have enough communication to inform you as to where's the best way to take a bypass to get around it? Does that sometimes occur, Rich? K2UPS, K2RIW.
No, only if it's a major problem that makes, like the major news, they might get alerted by it.